So it's just like we were all to go on a trail run and we're just going to chat. We're just going to talk about running and your experiences.
Oh, that's absolutely fine. It's an unusual and sensitive subject, and maybe it's also slightly peculiarly British.
And I think what we decided, this when Don left to go to the bathroom just a minute ago. Okay, here we go. You say on Fox Faith God.
Yeah, you see, all this stuff that you hear at the beginning, it's all very, very real.
It really is, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's not contrived. It is.
It's okay. Stupid is what it is.
Yeah. We are anti-professional. Okay, here we go.
That's beautiful.
You guys ready?
Oh, yeah.
Recording?
Are we recording?
You guys ready?
Are we recording?
Welcome to...
No.
Thanks for joining.
I'd be welcome too.
That's wrong. But I do it wrong. Okay.
Yeah. I'll say I'm Faith Goss. You say I'm Don Freeman. And, oh, okay. I Faith Goss got one.
Okay. Welcome to another edition of Trail Runner Nation. I'm Don Freeman.
I'm Faith Goss.
And I am Scott War. And we have a very interesting guest today. I'm gonna set this up. The guest we have is Warren Pohl.
The Warren Pohl?
Yes.
Okay.
The infamous Warren Pohl.
Right.
He is a Trail Nation member that emailed me this week. It was this week, and he was telling me about his recent 50-miler accomplishment. Was complimenting us on a recent podcast on where we talked about trail gods,
yeah,
and how you appease the trail gods, and he attributed his personal record on this 50-miler to appeasing the trail gods by picking up goo wrappers and trash, and he said, That's the reason why I finished so fast. And as we started talking more and more, I got to like this guy a lot. He has a very good sense of humor, and we decided let's invite him on the show. Now Warren Pohl, it's evening here in California, but Warren Pohl is a Brit, and it is 4:30 in the morning right now in Britain, in London. Is that right? Where are you located, Warren?
I am absolutely in the center of London, and praise be, it is a beautiful morning, so all the more worth getting up for.
How do you know it's dark?
No, it's not. This is the amazing thing. It's nearly summer over here, despite the fact it has been lashing with rain for the last week, and it's looked like winter. If you get up at this time, the sky is blue, and there's sort of some pink haze coming out because the sun's on its way up.
So you should be getting up at 4:30 every morning.
I can't believe I've been wasting these 2 hours by getting up at 6 every day.
Well, we're really pleased to have Warren. Warren is an accomplished ultra runner, self-proclaimed back of the packer, which is why we get along so well already. We're very, very close friends because we would be running the same pace. But he's also a writer, a reporter, an investigative reporter, and just a fun guy. He has a website at www.warrenpohl.com, and if you get a chance, we'll link this to our podcast, but you should go to that website. There's a video there, there's some photos. It's just a really fun website to take a look at. But thank you for joining us so early in the morning, Warren.
Well, look, thank you very much for inviting me on, guys. It's as I've said when we just caught up earlier, it is very surreal to be talking to you live now. Because normally I'd just be pottering about my daily business, listening to you on the headphones.
Did we mention we're not paying you for this? You don't need to butter us up.
What you mean? I shouldn't be referring you to my agent,
right?
for 15% of nothing, which is still nothing.
You have an agent.
Yeah, maybe we should be paying him.
I was gonna say maybe
Scott, you got to look deeper into these arrangements
maybe,
you make.
Maybe we need an agent.
Well, one word about agents, even though it's a digression from the running, that anyone who puts the word agent after their job is taking money for nothing. Do not get involved with them ever. And this is from someone who has one.
Yeah. See, and the trail knowledge begins to flow forth from Warren's mouth. So here's the other fun thing that we like to do. So Warren and I were talking, and I said, you know what, we need to have Warren on the podcast. And so I threw it out to him. I said, what do you want to talk about? What are your favorite running topics? And then he, I assume, probably took half a day to write a dissertation, a 2-page dissertation on some topics that he wanted to talk about. And they were just hilarious and very well written. And we're going to talk about some of those. I'd like to start out with the first one here, and I'll let you ramble on after I introduce this topic. The first topic is why British ultras aren't very cool compared to what I imagine American ones ought to be, or what the American ones are.
And that imagine thing, we will certainly embellish and perhaps, create that image that you have.
Yeah, we'll feed that image.
Okay, good.
Well, please bear in mind, you have fed it substantially to date, and my mental picture of American ultras is based on several sources, but a lot of those sources are this podcast.
Then we've done a good job of lying.
So what is an ultra like in Britain?
It is extremely lo-fi. The first one I ever did, it was about 40 people standing around in the rain and the dark, around a sort of a porter cabin. I don't know if you know what that is. It's
no.
Like the kind of building you would find on a construction site. You know, like it comes
like
in on the back
potty?
Of a truck. like a bit bigger than a porter potty. Enough space for maybe 12 people inside instead of half a person.
Sounds like a party.
A porta potty.
Porta party.
Say that once.
It's a sort of porta party potty cabin. It's just a sort of small square thing that's been dumped in the middle of a field. It has one window, one door, and it was locked. And we were waiting for the organizer to arrive. There was no porta potty, and things just went downhill from there, really. Just before anyone gets the wrong idea, I love ultra running in Britain. But this is what makes it so great, because when you look at it, there is nothing as a British ultra beyond the running. So you better be enjoying that if you want to turn up.
So I'm curious, did the race director ever show up?
Now, he showed up. He unlocked the door. he sort of went in and left us outside for a bit. And then just sort of came out and went, right, well, it's the start. Do you want to get going? And so we did, and you know, off you go, and you're left to it. And one thing that I was catching your most recent podcast with Sonny Blende, and my jaw was on the floor. You were talking about aid stations. You used words like banquet table and smorgasbord and reward. And, you know, the reward for getting to a UK aid station is that it's still there. And B, that it has anything. It's like, compared to what I hear about your races, it sounds like we're on wartime rationing. You might get some biscuits, which, I mean, I know you call these things cookies, but really, I think any American who was confronted with our biscuits and told it was a cookie would be insulted. Maybe some tea on occasion, but that'll normally be cold. Water out of a big plastic jug, which you have to fill yourself. Yeah, that's kind of it. A good hearty smile and a pat on the back. You'll get that at best. But I think Sonny said you'd asked her, what are your top four items to choose from the banquet table?
Yeah.
And we don't even have four items.
Oh, let me share with you, Warren, what's on an aid station table. I mean, we'd have to extend the podcast if we were just to talk about the variety.
Rack of lamb.
No, but
prime rib.
But literally, there are aid stations with soup and sometimes quesadilla and burritos, egg burritos sometimes. I've had pancakes.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Pancakes at some aid stations
ice,
early in the morning.
Ice cream
has been served.
That's a bad choice. Oh.
My favorite, I think it was like my third ultra, they had grilled cheese sandwiches and tomato
good.
Soup.
Yeah.
Oh,
yes. Yep.
Oh, yeah.
Which
yeah.
I've heard about that. I
actually got so hungry listening to your podcast yesterday. I had to buy a load of food on my way home. I've got a race coming up. I was trying to hold off all the sugars and everything like that. So clearly I hadn't eaten enough. I was waiting until I got home. I'll eat something healthy. And I was listening to your podcast. I couldn't. I bought a load of chocolate on the way home.
we're quite spoiled, and I would say the food is there, but the volunteers, you know, even sweeter than the food. We've got some great volunteers.
That's actually where we're very lucky with.
A good volunteer could turn a biscuit, cold tea, and some water into a delightful experience, no doubt.
No, so. I think that could be true. We do have them, but I think perhaps in a typically British way, they are more reserved. So, like I say, it's a kind of well done. that's warmth at an aid station. You have to bear in mind, and I think it was someone I picked up off your podcast, the people at the aid station have been there 10 hours. You know, you're just passing through, and it may be a grim time in the afternoon, and the wind's howling, and the rain's coming in, and you're on the side of some godforsaken canal somewhere, which is usually where British ultras run. And, you know, you're just passing through, but they have been there a long time. And if they can just manage just to lift the lip a little in what might be construed as a smile and say, well done, that's your warmth, that's your hug at that moment.
So if you don't have a lot of stuff at the aid stations, what are you, I mean, do you have to carry a pretty big pack with you with all your gear?
A trailer?
you could, a trailer might be an option. I certainly carry my own food because you really can't, there's normally the websites will not tell you in advance, even how many aid stations there are, let alone what's at them. So you can't really plan for that. So I always tend to carry some of my own stuff. But I think there's a hardiness bred among Brit runners. So the guys at the front, almost regardless of weather, are likely to be wearing shorts and T-shirt. And they pretty much don't carry anything. And to this day, even after 4 years of doing this, I have no idea how they're getting through or what they're getting through on.
Wow, that's interesting. Do they have crews? Do they have you know, friends and relatives that are meeting them along the trail and feeding them?
Well, if we were to take one portion of them, and I don't know whether you get these guys and girls in the US, the angry loner faction of the ultra running community. We seem to have quite a lot of those who turn up at British races.
We ship them to you.
We deport them.
Thank you so much. I mean, these guys can be incredible runners, but they you wouldn't want to get stuck in an elevator with them, perhaps. And I don't think they've got friends, period. So maybe there's no one to help them, but the guys at the front, if they do have aid, they're so far ahead of me, I've got no idea. They might see them with people at the end, which suggests that perhaps someone is feeding them a cheese sandwich on the way. But for the rest of the people, I don't know. I've seen people run into shops during races to buy food.
Really?
Oh yeah. I mean, I had to do it recently. We were running through a small village in Wales, and people were looking at us strangely because that'll happen in small villages in Wales. And it was just too hot, and there was nothing salty around, and I was all out of electrolytes. So I got a bag of chips, and that saved me.
So you have to bring some money with you.
Absolutely. That's another thing. You pull out. Well, you know, it's an ultra, it's self-sufficient. There's no one going to take you back to the start or the finish or where you need to go. So you're going to need a cab or a long walk.
Wow.
Or just another long race.
Well, exactly. You know, it's a good thing. There is no safety net in terms of pulling out. So you might as well get to the finish because that's where your bag is.
So do you ever, so you've gone to UTMB, is that correct?
That is correct, yeah. Be my third time this year that I've been.
So how was that race different than running in the UK?
Chalk and cheese. These races for me, when I travel to a race like UTMB, that is where it's a different world. So this is a different chance to run because you get there and clearly they have huge aid stations. They have soup, they have noodles, they have loads of fruit, cheese, meat. It's like I've just arrived in the promised land. And I feel that an American ultra, even a smaller one, might be more like this from what I hear. Great big banquet tables of food, maybe someone singing the national anthem as you come in, fireworks, you know. Whereas if you come to Britain, you're going to be running on a canal towpath. Now, I don't know, do you have canals over there?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. That's good to know. So you know what that is, but just make it wetter and grayer and more wind and probably a bit more in the middle of nowhere, and then throw loads of trash into the canal, you know, shopping carts and that sort of thing. Maybe some Polish guys smoking, looking unhappy, drinking heavily, regardless of the time of day, and pretending to fish. Not that there are any fish in there. There's a lot of that going on, and they will not get out of your way, and the path is only like a meter wide at best. So that's where you'll be running, and you'll be on your own. And finally, in the distance, you'll see a bridge. You know there's a aid station coming. You walk around there. One small trestle table, one guy looking pretty cold, one big bowser of water, maybe a bit of an orange and a couple of chocolate bars.
Well, chocolate's
welcome
not bad.
To Britain.
Chocolate's not bad. Hey, well, let's talk about the finish. You know, you run through the finish line, and here in the U.S., depending on the size of the event, it can be a carnival where there are, you know, booths set up with vendors that are showing, you know, the latest new trail shoes and different electrolyte drinks and that sort of stuff, where it can be fairly mellow. But still, there's a lot of people. There's a family and the friends that are congratulating you, and there's food.
Fellow trail runners.
Always food there. Sometimes there's even big meals, like we Thanksgiving meals with big turkey and stuffing and stuff like that. What is a finish line?
Are you guys having me on here, right?
No.
I feel like I'm just running into sort of, I don't know, the closing scenes of Uncle Buck or something at this point.
We need to send some pictures.
Yeah, please do.
Now tell me, like when we say, you know, I'm a kind of back of the pack sort of runner, and you guys say, well, we have that in common. So if you're even mid-pack, are you, you know, and back, are you expecting this sort of welcome at the finish?
Oh, absolutely,
yeah.
And is this finish in the middle of nowhere, or is it near civilization?
No, they're
there's a parking lot, so cars can arrive.
There's access. There's access, but it's usually, you know, away from real busy areas, because there a lot of people park there. I mean, there could be, you know, hundreds of people at the finish line.
But I would say that people that are parking there are coming for the race.
Right,
it's not
right.
like they're parking and shopping.
Right.
How about the massage tables? Did you mention that?
Some
of the bigger races, there's sports massage tables set out there, and you can get a free massage.
Wow. I'm like I say, my jaw is still on the floor. These are things that I hear about, and I see them, UTMB and some of the other big European races. But just as an example, it's probably one of the more extreme ones. Actually, it's not. There is a race in Britain. It's called the Grand Union Canal. Might be called the Grand Union Canal Ultra, although I believe it started as a walk that long ago. The ultras perhaps hadn't been invented, and now it's considered an ultra, clearly, because it's 144 miles.
Wow.
You start in the city of... the finish line, it's in the heart of London, in this little canal basin that's actually about half a mile from where I live. And I was walking to the pub, clearly for a fruit juice, with a friend the other night.
Of course.
And we were, of course, you know, he was drinking, but not me, but we were walking down the canal. And in the sort of darkness ahead of me, I saw this little banner, and it can't have been more than 3 meters wide and a meter high, and it said, finish. And behind it was one easy up now, but it was probably a quarter the size of a regular one in the US. You could have got, I reckon, six people under it.
Okay.
One table, one man in a coat sort of with a camera waiting for the finishers. And I said, I thought this must be some little local race or something. I said, what race is this? He said, oh, this is the finish of the Grand Union Canal. And there was nobody there. Admittedly, it was nighttime, but only 8 o'clock in the evening on a Sunday. And this one guy came in, and there were, me and my friend stayed to clap him in. And there were six people clapping, I think, as this chap arrived. And that was sort of it.
Yeah.
And he'd done 144 miles.
Oh, my.
I would say at the end of like American ultras, I think the later you come in, sometimes the more enthusiastic the crowd is.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, we certainly get that there's a drive that gets you to the finish, and even those four people clapping, that's, you know, that's a reward in itself. But there's fanfare is distinctly lacking in all of our big races, certainly all of the ones I've done in this country.
Well, just to throw insult to injury, sometimes at the end of an American race, they'll have a keg of beer waiting for you to finish.
Wow.
The Patagonia Lounge, you're referring to, with couches and... Yeah,
but are these bigger races? I mean, this like end of the UTMB. It's a huge party. The whole town is given over to it. There are people cheering you from like 10 miles out, and that's such a big event. But is this sort of thing happening at smaller events? I mean, by smaller event, how many runners would you have over there?
You know, I've run some smaller ones that are 50 people. To 100 people, and yeah. No, it's not like that. But they're still, you know, everybody that's racing usually has, you know, three or four or five or a half a dozen friends that are showing up, and so and usually we hang out there at the finish and kind of clap in some more people. We don't, you know, finish the race and hop in our cars and go home.
Maybe that's a weather thing. Would that happen when it was cold as well?
Pretty good weather.
We're in California. It's not very cold here.
You know, we go on.
I'm somewhat attracted to the hardy roughness of a ultra run there in England. You know, you guys are real ultra runners.
Yeah,
I see there is a beauty to it because, as I said earlier, and you know, I wouldn't be doing it if there wasn't, because the only thing that's really there to get fired up about is the running. You know, if you're there for anything else, you're going to be sorely, sorely disappointed.
So let's get back to the finish. So you do finish, you know, here in the US, it's customary, at least for, all 100 mile races that I'm aware of. And some of the shorter distance, 100K, I'm not sure about 50 milers, but at least 100 Ks and all of the 100 milers, you finish, and there's a belt buckle, which I know is really strange,
but not all of them, but a majority, many of them, it all
comes back to you know, the Western States Trail run and how that all started. And you've heard that story a million times. What does someone that runs an ultra in the UK end up with?
Well, you get your bag back. which is a good start, because invariably then you can get home. No, you get a medal usually.
Okay.
It'll be very, very basic. It may have the name of the race on it,
or it may not. Is that what you're alluding to? Is that
sometimes it's a generic medal? On occasion, the majority no, but the generic medals are not unknown. And sometimes the ribbon holding the medal is quite flimsy and it might break before you get home. But you know, hopefully you can get that up on the mantel shelf. Let's see, what else? No, we don't get anything else.
You get a race t-shirt?
On occasion you get a race t-shirt, yes. But again, it's not, I'd probably maybe 50% of the time, but they're often really bad. They don't fit anybody. they're in colors that you wouldn't wish on your worst enemy. They're designed by presumably school children, by the looks of it. And even though they look technical, they don't feel it. And so they're not even good for use in the garage for cleaning stuff up, because they're vaguely technical, so they don't absorb anything. In many cases, it would be better not to have it. They smear. They just move water around. You know, you're trying to dry your bicycle with that thing, forget it.
So I'm assuming with this lackluster of aid stations and tchotchkes, if you will, at the end of a race, they must be fairly affordable races. I mean, the race fees must be fairly affordable.
I'd like to think they are. I've actually just finished a piece recently for Runner's World looking at race value in the UK. And generally, things seem to be pretty healthy. So I would imagine our average, say you enter a 50 miler over here, you're going to pay about £40 to £50, which is what, $60 to $80?
That's about right for here. Is it $100 for a 50?
Yeah, well,
$125.
What did AR?
What was
AR
50?
Was like 150, 180. $180.
Yeah.
But ooh, wow, $180.
Yeah. Yeah, but there's a Patagonia jacket that's about a $125 jacket retail, and a shirt that's $35 retail.
Not to mention the buffets. Oh, along the buffets. The way.
Yeah,
there's the fireworks, the anthem, the buckle, the free truck.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a difference here, but there's still I think the one thing that may be similar, even though it's on a much smaller scale, the race organizer will always be there to see you in, and there will at least be a couple of people, and their congratulations and well done, while it doesn't come with fanfare, you know it's hard earned, and only the small number of people who are there, at least they understand what you've just done. You know, you get that feeling of having you've achieved personally, but it is recognized, and there is a warmth, but it sounds so different to America.
we had fun, poking at one another on the comparison between, this ultra over here and there, but there are, like you said, a lot of similarities, and probably more than we realize. Just camaraderie that happens on the trail, people helping other people, runners that are in support of other runners. I'm sure that's we wouldn't know whether we were running in England or over here if we were and dropped down in the middle of a trail.
And frankly, I would guess that most ultra runners here in the U.S. would still be running those races even if there wasn't aid stations. I don't think anybody signs up for an ultra to go eat at an aid station. It's not that good.
Right.
But then don't you find that the running makes the food better? Anything
absolutely.
At that point.
Absolutely.
Anything.
You can have stale saltine crackers and
you don't know
it's a
difference.
Gourmet food.
Yeah.
Now you're just showing off about your buffets again, aren't you?
we
dream of stale crackers.
And there's things that I've eaten at an aid station that I never would otherwise eat, like an insurer. I was waiting till my eighth or ninth decade in life
to have
an insurer.
Do you know what an insurer is, Warren?
I have no idea. It sounds like an insurance policy, and I've got one that's for my car, but
no, it's a dietary drink that's usually reserved for people, in
over 90 years old. It's like a drink for the elderly people
in the end stages of life when you need essential nutrients.
People that don't have teeth.
Malnourished.
Brilliant. Presumably not good for the incontinence, though. So it needs.
But perfect when you're bonking and in terrible spot in an aid station, and I thought this will either take me out of the race completely or it'll help me, and it helped
me. 50-50 shot, right?
Yeah.
What do you call a bonk over in the UK?
Oh well, we still call it a bonk, but because that appears to be the common term. But what's should be known, if you're not aware and you're using this term commonly while in Britain, is that bonking is also slang for having sex.
Oh, so a bonk could be very good.
A bonk could be superb. It's slightly old school speak, but if you said to a non-endurance sports person or someone who wasn't aware of the world that you bonked last night,
it's
more than an eyebrow.
I bonked twice last night.
Yeah, I just kept bonking. I have been bonking for weeks, and I just need to eat.
I'm having trouble with bonking.
I need some electrolytes.
I wondered if you could advise me on my bonk. That's a deeply personal question, so it's worth bearing in mind depending on your audience over here.
Yeah, okay. Pulling it into an aid station, I think I'm bonking.
No, you look fine.
Okay. Well, hey, Warren, one other topic that you wanted to talk about is one of the best pieces of advice you ever received as an ultra runner. Why don't you go ahead and talk about that?
After I had been through an in-depth bonking lesson from several far superior bonkers to myself, it was actually bonking that drove this very question, because it's always been an issue for me. And this is just sounding worse now the translation as well. We're talking about the sports version of bonking here.
It could be sporty. I've known some good athletes.
That just sounds even worse. Yes, we're talking about the running out of energy. I'm not helping myself.
You're talking about the professional bonker.
I am talking about the professional short on energy
bonk.
Got it.
I was discussing the subject of bonking. I was lucky enough to be talking with Sebastian Chenier, who has come second in the UTMB several times, and is just an all-round standout inspirational guy for me. He's probably my ultimate running hero.
Has he bonked?
He's a Frenchman, of course. He
bonks. No, not that kind of bonk.
He bonks.
Le bonk.
Not that kind of bonking. The running type of bonking.
Well, he doesn't clearly. He's near superhuman. He's like Scott Jurek and the rest of them. Yeah. But I asked him. In 2009, I had landed a UTMB entry. It was a total fluke. I had finished Marathon de Sable that year, and a paper that I write for over here wanted some extreme adventure stories. I put UTMB down as a story idea, and thinking that, you know, this will make me look good, and better still, they will never go for it because it's far too niche. And surprise, surprise, that was the one they went for. So I had 6 weeks to prepare.
Wow.
Yeah, I had no idea what I was getting in for. But I arrived there, and my ultra knowledge was tiny at that point. And I had this big problem with running out of energy. And I looked at Sebastian, and he's a very slight guy, and he's obviously super powerful, incredible runner. And I said, what do you eat when you're running? And I thought he would come back and say, well, Warren, what I do is I have a gel every hour, and then every 2 hours I have my electrolyte drink, and then I have a bar here, and then at 5 hours I'll take some tablets, and on we go. And there would be a plan, like the kind of plan I had been using, based on, you know, the back of a power bar wrapper. And instead, he just said to me, you must listen to your body. Just give it what it needs. And his French accent was real, not as bad as that one. I just thought he was having me on to start with, until I realized, it dawned on me that in that single comment, I was understanding that he was on a different plane. He did understand his body. He didn't need to be going on, you know, looking at his watch or listening, you know, looking at his heart rate or thinking, when should I eat this? Everything he did was driven by signals from within that he was tuned into. And so I tried that when I bonked spectacularly in the UTMB. I went out far too hard. I would never have been able to even finish it then anyway. And at 40 miles, I was broken in two. I was a shuffling, shambling wreck. And I got to an aid station, and there was an American style smorgasbord in there, perhaps with a bit more meat and cheese, it being France. And I looked at this stuff and I said, right, body, what do you want? And the body went, coffee, cake, and chocolate. So okay, I'm listening. Here we go. I'm going to do what Sebastian does, and I'm going to rip on to the finish. And I nearly threw up. I realized at that point, I was trying to listen to my body and I couldn't hear it at all. And ever since then, every little thing that I've learned since, and I've been lucky enough to work and talk with a number of people since I started writing about running after getting more into it. And it just all seems to filter back to that. You know, and that is just at the heart, I believe, of really beginning to understand ultra running.
So are you finding that you are more in tune with your body and you can understand what your body needs and wants?
Very slowly, yes. So I've recently stopped using a heart rate monitor at all. And before I sort of weaned myself off it by stopping with it in training and then still kept it at the races because the signals from my body, I wasn't tuned in enough. So I just needed that heart rate to know that I wasn't going to blow up too early.
Mm-hmm.
And then with the eating as well, I got rid of all the sports nutrition and saw a huge improvement, and just eat regular food little and often, and just try and, rather than thinking, right, it's half an hour, I must eat, I'll think, well, in half an hour, I will think about eating, and if I feel like it, I will, rather than I must, you know, all that horrible bloated, sick feeling that certainly I had in the early days, and I think is common for a lot of people. But I'd be interested to know what your experiences of it are, and whether you think it's a meaningful thing from what your experiences are, or is this just something that I'm learning?
Well, you know, you've just struck on my favorite ultra running topic, which is listening to your body.
Yeah,
it you know, it is what ultra running is to me. every bit of success is driven from learning to listen to your body. And when you mentioned about using your heart rate monitor initially, and I never thought about this until you just said it, that when you use your heart rate initially, you're learning to listen to your body and you're listening to a physiological piece of data that's coming in. And pretty soon you can start predicting exactly what's on that watch. You could say, I should be at 145 right now. Yep, 145. You've learned then and been educated how to listen to your body, and it's a training tool. And as soon as you master it, you can get rid of it. It's nice to check in every now and then. But if you can listen and learn your heart rate and that effort level, you can learn everything else too. You can start using those same skills, that same skill set of listening to your heart rate and listening to thirst, listening to hunger, listening to pace, listening to intensity, listening to everything else, that mental chatter that's going on. And you can just sit back and run this spaceship that your body is and dial it in to exactly what you need to do by listening to it. And that's my favorite topic. We could talk about this until the night sky happens over in Britain.
That will be a lengthy podcast.
He can do it. I've run with him for a long time, and he could talk that long, I guarantee you.
I say the same thing over and over. Scott doesn't know it. He just shakes his head.
It's because I keep forgetting. I'm getting that age where by the time he repeats himself, I forgot what he said.
Well, that's a good friend. It keeps you interested.
Yeah.
So, I think that that's exactly the point of listening to each one of those parameters. And there are many pieces of data that do come in on an ultra run. And that's what makes the sport so fun and ever changing. Environment changes, race changes, your position changes of how you're feeling. And all of that is very, very interesting to listen to.
Well, there's definitely people say who don't run ultras, they say, well, you know, what do you do? What are you thinking about? And it seems to split into that time when you're drifting versus the time when you're having a hateful, horrible black moment that you're trying to grind through. And then the other 50% of the time is just, like you say, it's checking in with yourself. And, you know, it's how do I feel? And am I hungry? Is that calf a bit sore? Or, you know, should I be remembering to breathe from my stomach and just slowly assimilating what the body's doing to keep going. It's like you're a you know, the best diagnostic computer that any car could have. Your body can far outstrip that if we just learn how to do it. And there's a massive reward in slowly unpicking it and getting back to yourself rather than relying on heart rate monitors or technology to do it.
You know, I've been on the race and have had headphones with you know, plenty of, you know, 20 hours of music ready to go at any time.
And 20 hours of podcasts, of course.
Of course. Of course. And I've only listened to a couple songs during the entire race because I'm too busy. Mm-hmm. I'm busy thinking and checking in because it's all business at that point. You know, I cannot take a chance of not paying attention and slipping off the edge and then trying to recover for the rest of the miles. It's a slippery slope and a dangerous place. You've got to be right on the edge all the time. And so you have to be thinking, you know, about what's happening.
No, absolutely. And I think as well, something that I've been learning in the last year is that listening to your body doesn't begin and end with the race.
Absolutely.
Because afterwards, you know, you've got to just in terms of recovering, in terms of managing your body, whether it's you know, stretching, foam rollering, what training you should be doing today. If you've got it written, you know, a person uses a training diary and it says, you know, right, today is a long slow run and you don't feel like it, well, perhaps you should listen to your body and maybe there's a reason sometimes that you should be doing something else or perhaps even putting your feet up for another day. It can help you with your rest period too, I think.
Absolutely.
Yeah, go ahead, Scott.
I was going to change the subject a little bit, so go ahead and say what you were going to say.
No, we've got to go till nightfall in England.
Oh, that's right.
We've got at least another 18 hours to go because it is summer and we are, it looks like we might even get some sunshine today, which will be a miracle.
Then you better get on your trainers and get out there.
I've got my trainers on already.
Oh, wow. You slept in them, huh?
Yeah, well, I just, you know, I didn't know if you guys had a camera or something. I thought I better look like a runner. I thought I just could see the fraud that I am otherwise.
Well, the comment I was going to make is back to the nutrition part of it. And you know, Sonny Blende has talked about this before on one of the podcasts we've done. And she said, you know, those beginner runners need, and many times, some of those gel packs or nutrition bars or, you know, electrolyte drinks because their stomachs aren't trained to handle that real food. And it sounds like you've gotten to the point where that stuff isn't palatable necessarily for you anymore. And you've trained your stomach that even though you're running these long distances, you can take in that real food.
Yeah, definitely. It was interesting to hear her say that, actually, because seeing it through my own experience, then I had the idea that since I junk sports nutrition, performance, that had been a key to a big performance step forwards. So I was like, well, all sports nutrition must be bad. And then when she was saying this, I was like, hang on, that makes perfect sense. You know, it's a way in, the same way the heart rate monitor gets you going and can teach you to start listening to your body. But as I think you guys have been saying, you need to know when to start weaning yourself off it if you want to progress. There's an argument for doing that with the sports nutrition as well. And of course, if something's working, you know, don't worry about it. But
right.
I mean, the permanent sickness that I had from kind of 5 hours on in any ultra has all but disappeared now. And I originally thought that was just a part of running ultras, and it's not at all. It doesn't have to be.
So what do you eat? What normal food do you eat?
Biscuits and tea.
Biscuits, tea, and whatever's at the aid stations, which clearly is normally not a lot, mixed up with cheese sandwiches. That's a good one for my savory, I find. And then for my sweet option, I have a thing called malt loaf, and I don't know if you have that over there.
No, what's that?
It is a very black, sticky bread type thing that is soaked in kind of raisins and fruit juice, and it's really moist, and you just slice it and you put butter on it. And it's absolutely wonderful because it's so moist, it's easily digestible, it gets energy in, and it's still, I'll eat it when I'm not running, even if I've, you know, I can quite happily use it during a race over 10 hours and then still want to eat whatever's left in my bag when I get to the end.
Sounds pretty sugary and calorie dense, is that right?
Definitely. Okay. It's pretty old school. It would be a very common energy food if you go to a race in the north of England, particularly a fell race, which is they're as low fi as racing in Britain gets, but they are also as hardcore as racing in Britain gets. These are just mountain goats of people who live in the hills of Britain, who come out and run in vests and shorts and plimsolls, just like their dad did and their dad before them, and regardless of the weather. And they will use, you know, if they eat anything, maybe, you know, malt loaf might even be a bit fancy for them, but it's real lo-fi old school food, but it works.
Do you make your own, or do you buy that at the local grocery?
I buy that at the local grocery, and it comes in a handy size as well. Kind of one bar is about enough for one 50 miler normally.
Okay.
It's good stuff. What about you guys? What are you carrying, or are you just simply waiting for your great big banquet and, you know, the waiter to get your table ready at your next aid station?
We don't have those on training runs, Warren. Yeah, it's just at the races.
I like that Bonk Buster
bar. We're bursting
bar.
The bubble here.
Yeah, go ahead.
I like the Bonk Buster bar, which there is actually a Bonk Buster.
Oh, yeah, I've seen that.
They're good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I haven't tried it.
The oat, I think blueberry oat. Oh, man, that's good.
It sounds dense.
Good.
Yeah. Peanut butter and jelly is a good food for me. You know, I like a banana.
Oh, yeah. That's like the only thing that I cannot do. I burp a lot.
You'd run a lot faster if you ate bananas.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Would you eat a banana in normal life, Faith?
Oh, yeah. I eat bananas like every day, but I've tried them before working out and during working out, and it makes me burp a lot. I don't like the taste of burpy banana.
I like
over here, I don't know.
The Justin peanut butter.
Oh yeah.
Those are have so you good. Have you heard of those over in Britain, Justin's peanut butter?
I have only heard of those through your podcast. These sound like another magical invention.
We're going to send you some because we're going to get you a Cocopelli if you already have them, but if you don't.
Yeah,
I don't think we have them anywhere.
Okay.
We'll get you some. It's like a little bit bigger than a gel packet. and it's different flavors of peanut butter. So there's like hazelnut so and
hazelnut and honey.
I don't know what they are,
yeah,
but
peanut butter and honey.
They're delicious.
Oh,
here's my question:
Is it like a cookie or a cake?
No, it's
a
peanut butter. It's just peanut butter
like in a
goo.
Oh, really?
Like
yeah.
in a goo package. Tear the top.
Oh, so
and
literally,
squeeze.
You're just canning in a load of mixed up peanut butter.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Wow. That
does
sound good.
Just not peanut butter.
It's Justin peanut butter.
Yeah, it's Justin.
Do you guys have Pepsi there?
As
have
in
you
the drink?
Never traveled?
Yeah.
Pepsi's a worldwide company.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did I insult you? Okay,
no.
I'm sorry.
No.
Across the line.
It's fine. We do have Pepsi.
I'm going to go home.
Don't only tend to drink it in the European, as in sort of mainland Europe, France and Italy and places. You'll find it at the aid stations there, but very rarely in the UK.
Well, that's my aid station food.
Okay. You like the Pepsi?
I like the Pepsi.
So, Warren...
Flat Pepsi.
We have had a lot of fun with you, but I have a couple other questions for you that we need to delve into. One is... You are currently training for your third UTMB.
We should qualify that. I am training for my third visit to the UTMB. So visit number one was the abortive one.
Yeah.
Where I realized that ultra running was much more than I had ever imagined, and it set me off on a path and became a sort of my burning obsession to go back and finish. And last year, I ran the CCC, which is the shorter version of the same course.
How far is that?
That is, I believe it's 62 miles.
Okay.
And so I figured if I can do that, you know, I realize this is a different beast. I have to attack it. You know, it's got to be a long buildup. I finished that, and I told myself throughout the last probably 6 hours of that race that I'm never running another ultra again. I am going to go and do shorter events. Why should I do this ridiculous sport that takes upwards of 20 hours to get your result? I was in a miserable place, and I crossed that line and I felt completely different. I was ready to sign up for the UTMB there and then. And I thought, no, this is just emotion getting the better of you. Remember how bad you were feeling. And then I bumped into Sebastian Chenu, who I've already mentioned is my all-time running hero. And he said, you know, a race like the UTMB, it takes 4 or 5 years to get ready. And I thought, well, I'm nearly 4 years in. Why would I give up now? So I've put everything I can into returning for the third time to the race. But it'll be my second time of starting the UTMB. But I hope this will be the year that I can finish it.
Well, we are really looking forward to hearing that. And I speak for all three of us. I hope I speak for all three of us. We'd love to have you on again, and especially to hear about your result at UTMB. I think UTMB is like end of August. Is that right?
It is. It's the very last weekend of August, crossing into September.
Okay.
What is it about that? He can't go yet, Scott. We've got more to talk to him
about. No, I'm not trying to cut this short.
It's nearly time for me to get up. You know, I've got all the time in the world. I don't even start.
It's only 5:30 a.m. It's only 5:30 a.m. There. He's still in bed.
Perfect. What is it about that spot? Because I've been in that same spot of running in deep into the miles and saying, you know what, this is ridiculous. What am I doing this for? You know, I should be doing X, Y, Z, and I could think of anything. It makes more sense than this. And then all of a sudden I'm doing a training run on Monday and signing up for another race. What is that dark spot that we go through and we get all that mental chatter?
I think it's a beautiful place. The darkest places are the best ones, and they're the ones that actually keep you running, because while you're in it, it's hateful. Everything is wrong. Everything is black. You've picked the wrong sport. You just, nothing could be going right, or you never want to do it again. But if you can keep putting one foot in front of the other, you will come out of that. And the transition that brings you back into the light mentally, I think, is probably where the biggest reward in ultra running is found. And you don't get it without going into the dark. So what do you think? Is that just me being a bit weird, or is there something in there?
I think that is the best definition of what we call the dark side or the dark place that I've ever heard. I'm not joking. I think that was very, very well stated.
Well, thank you.
I'm going to write that down and
it's
plagiarize
on a podcast.
It.
It's not a podcast. You don't have to write it down. Just listen to it.
Yeah,
Scott.
I think you can download it. There's a website called Trail Runner.
Oh, rats.
Nation.
I thought I could attribute that to me. Darn it.
No, go for it.
I think it's overcoming that spot that is very defines human nature. You know, the ability to overcome and be faced with something so significant that you want to turn and run from it, and then you bust through it. I think that's life. I think we need that. I think it makes us stronger and defines our character.
And I think it surprises me every time it's happened to me. It surprises me that you, like you said, Warren, you can come out of it. And if you persevere long enough, you will come out of it. Things will change. Things will get better. And it surprises me every time that happens. I know that it's going to happen. I keep telling myself, that's why you keep putting the one foot in front of the other. But when it does happen, you go, you know what? 5 miles ago, I was ready to give this up and lay down and crawl in a, you know, fetal position and die.
And now, sit there rocking quietly and crying.
And humming the national anthem in my head. But now I actually feel okay.
And how can the body do that?
It's an amazing thing, isn't it?
It's absolutely astonishing. And one of the other things I've found, I don't know if this would be true for you as well, when you're really in one of those dark places, and perhaps you get to an aid station and there's a friend there, or you bump into someone along the way, and maybe someone takes a picture of you. And then later after the race, you see that picture and you look at the person in that picture, and the person in that picture never looks as bad as the way you felt at the time. And you're like, well, hell, if I look all right, you know, I can't really have been that bad. A lot of it must have been in my head.
You know, that's a great point.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's some times that I've seen that very picture. I can think of the aid station and, you know, I didn't look much different than I did when I was feeling good. So I guess it was in my head.
Maybe.
You know, getting ready for a race, you expect those things, those times to come, and you just welcome them. You say, here you are. I knew you were going to show up. I didn't know what mile it was going to show up, but I'm going to work through this now, and I'm glad I know that you're here now so I can put you behind me.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
You may get one or two of them, but they're not continuous. Have you ever run it and have it happen and never go away? No. It goes away. Yeah.
I think I've had that happen once, and I think that was primarily due to an enormous bonk in the very early days, and by which again I mean the running out of energy while you're running bonk.
Well, you know, Faith said, "Well, bite your tongue, be careful what you say, and what you wish for. It's going to happen to you." You know, you're testing the trail gods now, and pointing your finger at them, but I mean the depths, the darkest spot. You may not be in full daylight and come out of it, but it's going to be better than it was.
Yeah,
that's what I mean. It gets a little bit better.
The magic's in that transition, and you don't get it without going into the horrible places. And if there were no horrible places, it would be a much easier sport. And if it were a much easier sport, it probably wouldn't have the rewards or the drive to make any of us do it.
So how is that translated into your personal life? Has not to get too personal, but as you come across other, you know, adversity, do you draw on your experience with ultra running?
Absolutely. I think on the one hand, it taught me that in the early days, I could sort of get my head down and endure, whereas actually I should perhaps be smarter and train a little harder, but, you know, work on areas of running I was less comfortable with, you know, threshold and pushing things to try and, you know, rather than just know that I was going to grind something out, maybe get it done a bit quicker. And I try and translate that into my working life, but it doesn't work very well. I'm terrible at procrastinating, and, you know, I'm a freelance journalist. I work at home. The internet is like having, you know, every book, magazine, film, and album you ever wanted at your fingertips 24/7, and there's no one looking over my shoulder. So I need to try and translate a bit more of what I've learned from ultra running into my day-to-day life. I could actually even be a half decent journalist if I did that, I think.
I think you're being very humble there.
No, it honestly, it's I think I have more focus running than I do working. And, you know, maybe I need to address that balance, but that's for another day, because right now it's everything is about the UTMB. So.
As it should be, probably. So,
Well, perhaps.
Yeah. So I have one other question. You live right in the heart of London. Where do you go to run? Are you training on roads, or are you trying to get out of town?
I enter a lot of races because that gets me out of town. It forces me to get up, get out of town. And I think, like, it's, again, something you've said on your podcast before. It's like a training run with aid stations, and that just makes life easier. So I do a lot of races, and there is one park just outside of London, which is a good sort of 7 mile trail lap. And that's a staple place for me to go. And then I don't like running on roads at all, if I can help it. So we have a couple of parks within there's all the central London parks are within a stone's throw of my house, but there's another one that's just probably a couple of miles away called Hampstead Heath. And that's for London anyway, it's a big rambling place. It's got some hills. So you can't run mountains there, but, you know, you can find a sort of 1 to 200 meter hill, and you can run up and down that all day long, which will help. But Hampstead is an interesting environment. It's wild. It's really, in places you could be really out in the wilderness, but even though you're still in London. But it is also very popular of an evening, and has been historically for years, with London's gay community due to the cover it affords in the center of this town. So the first time I ran around there, and it was late, and then, you know, the sun was going down, I'm like, there are a lot of well-dressed men hanging around in this wood. What are they doing? And then, of course, it twigged. So you maybe need to just be aware of what time it is you're running there. You know, maybe that's your drive to go there, to be attached. Maybe that keeps you going. Or maybe, you know, you might just want to think, well, you know, it's 7 o'clock on a Saturday evening, I might run somewhere else tonight, you know. But those are sort of my go-to places, between Hampstead Heath, Hyde Park, and then Richmond Park being the one out of town. They'll keep me ticking over and until the next race or event gets me out.
The sport is just exploding over here. In America, people, there's more and more trail runners out there, new faces, which is great. Trails are plenty. There's plenty of trail out there to share with everybody. How about you? Is the sport growing over in England?
I think it's definitely growing, but from inside it, the perception is it's growing a lot faster than it is. I think that most people still have no idea it exists, and those that do, think it must be impossible. And a lot of the things I've tried to write on the sport is really saying it's not. You know, if you've run a marathon and you've still been running over the finish line, well, technically you've run an ultra, because you've run beyond marathon distance. So, you know, 50K is not that far beyond that. You've just got to start changing gear and changing your pace. And I've tried to sort of, ultra marathon, I think, can sound quite scary. And that's nice for those of us who do it, because people who don't run sort of think you're some kind of superhero, when we all know there's a difference,
or there's something wrong with you.
That too, yes, it can alienate a few people. But really, it's very achievable. So there is definitely a growing, you know, races that 3 years ago you would have turned up to see 30 people and a dog, you might find upwards of 100 people there now.
Well, Warren, we have really enjoyed our time with you, and I'm actually excited to maybe pay attention to the UTMB this year and follow it a little bit more, because I have a friend running it.
There we go.
So we've really enjoyed it. We'd love to have you back on again, and we were just really...
I'd encourage people to go to his website and read a couple of articles. I started reading the one about you were fitted in Lance Armstrong's bike, his gear, and you compared it with what you had, which was like a ski jacket and a pair of galoshes or something. And now all of a sudden you're on a carbon fiber bike and Lycra. And I thought it was a fascinating piece that you had written. So I think there's probably plenty more of those hidden in that on your website.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably due a bit of an update, but then fortunately, anyone coming to it who comes from this site will not have read anything on there before. It's I mean, it's not the kind of thing I put up there generally for passing traffic. It's more for work. You know, when I've got new people who I'm writing for, they can at least look at that and see where I'm at. But yeah, if you wanted to get an idea of the kind of thing I do, then that is precisely where you would find it. But guys, really, thank you so much for inviting me on. It was very unexpected, and it's been an absolute pleasure talking with you. And this kind of interaction, where, you know, meeting people like yourselves and talking more about the sport, it just fires me up more to run. And I hope it's the same for everyone else. The podcast on its own has been doing that for me, and I really, you know, thank you for that, because there's not a lot that we can find for that sort of thing over here. I just love the spin that you put on it. It's really much more casual, and it's very positive. But some of the people you get on and the information that comes in, it's wonderful.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
It motivates us just to do it. That's one of the reasons why we do it, is it helps us to get up at 4:30 in the morning and go running.
Yeah, I look forward to returning the compliment somehow, although I'm not sure how I get you lot to get up at 4:30 in the morning.
Well, thanks. Thanks very much. Trail Runner Nation members, thanks for joining us. We hope you had a good long run. We hope you had a good laugh. We hope you learned a little bit more about bonking and
listening to your body.
Now go out and run.